On Robin Hood Radio, we are delighted to have Chris Weld, the founder and CEO of Berkshire Mountain Distillers in Sheffield, Massachusetts, back with us. How are you, Chris?
I am wonderful and delighted to be back with you.
All right. Well, that's very good. And I just have to say that the recipes, they're not called recipes. The cocktail, we have been running the cocktail that you have been made. Here's, I'm going to automatically show, you know, that I don't know the terminology for distillery talk, but that we've been made, have been made with your spirits or can be made with your spirits, and I always find them very compelling. So that's good news. How did you, just out of curiosity, did you wake up one morning and say, I'm going to make a distillery?
Boy, that's a long question there. So I'd been working in the emergency room and was a little burnt out. My wife and I had moved back to the East Coast 20 years ago to Sheffield, and we landed on a somewhat neglected apple farm that had a wonderful historic spring on it. And so I was looking for a change. Figured I'd just start making apple brandy with the apples that we had. And we had this historic spring water, and it would be easy as could be, and jumped in feet first, and that was 15 years ago, only feels like 30 years ago.
And just out of curiosity, because it sounds suspiciously like the way Marshall and I started this radio station, did you have any idea? I mean, again, Marshall knew a lot about radio, but did you know from your emergency room experience a lot about apple brandy?
No. I had a fair amount of knowledge garnered over years of research about drinking. I had a biochemistry background that certainly helped with the chemistry on it, but I did not know much about Calvados itself. Shortly after jumping into the distilling realm, I realized that I would never make a living, at least in the U.S., selling an apple brandy. So I branched out somewhat immediately into making gins and rum and vodka and then some whiskeys as well.
And that sounds, again, familiar. Marshall started an internet radio station, and he was on for about a 45 seconds, literally, before he realized that he had to be over that there was more to it than I don't want to say more to it, but just that you needed the immediacy and you needed the actual infrastructure. Was it hard to get everything in train?
It was an awful lot of 100-hour weeks. There were, at that point, maybe there were 50 craft distilleries in the country. There are now about 2,700. And so it was pretty much trial and error. People couldn't give you advice. Your local attorney couldn't help. There's nobody to really hire with getting through the TTB. So it was definitely trial and error, and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But it was hard. I think initially my thought was that the hardest thing would be to be making wonderful spirits, and then they just sell themselves. But it turns out it's somewhat of a loaded system, and the hard part is selling your spirits and the making quality spirits when you're fortunate to have the local resources we have and wonderful water. Seem to be, at least in the long run, sort of the easier component of that.
There was a time, and I don't know what year it was, how many years later, where, basically everyone had, everyone in quotes had essentially decided to have their own craft brewery, basically, or craft. I don't know. The whole craft, small brewery thing really took off, but that was a few years after. You were on the vanguard of this, yes?
Yeah, I was definitely on the forefront. I mean, there were some pioneers in the industry before I got started, and there were some laws that the feds passed that allowed for craft distilleries. Originally, craft breweries and wineries had been legalized. And the premise was that it would allow these small farms to become viable business entities But when you look at the craft, the quote, farm distilleries, most of them are not even close to being on a farm. So, but I think in general, it's that the groundswell of any of these artisanal movements, whether it be charcuterie or cheese or bread or beer, wine, or spirits, that, you know, in total, we bring a lot to local communities. I mean, nobody goes to Portland, Maine and says, oh my gosh, they had all these wonderful chain restaurants. You know, it's the unique restaurants and the craft brewers and distilleries and small locally owned businesses that add the character. So, I mean, way back when in New England, there were hundreds of rum distilleries. And now there's, you know, and for a long time, there were none.
I could go in two different directions with that. The first was we could talk about how perfect Sheffield – did Sheffield have its own rum distillery?
Sheffield, I don't believe, had its own rum distillery, but there's some interesting stuff from the Historical Society about there was a mandatory commitment for people to come help build a town hall, and there was a paragraph about how – beer and rum, R-H-U-M, would be provided for free, and if you didn't come help, there'd be a fine. So there was certainly,
some inducement.
A lot of distilleries in the area, but I do not believe Sheffield had its own rum distillery. I do know that during Prohibition, there were a couple distilleries in Sheffield, and we actually have one of the stills on display on loan at the distillery.
Oh, that's cool. And again, this is, and you give tours at the distillery, right? Where there are...
You know, we stopped giving tours during COVID, but we have these self-guided tours, and we're always around to sort of discuss the process. So we still do complimentary tastings 7 days a week, though.
So basically you can come in and you can, under the guise of having a tour, taste the product.
Yeah, there's no strings attached. You can come in and taste the products and not have to walk around and read the placards and talk about a tour.
Sounds like something after my own heart, but never. At least the information is there for people who want it, and that's pretty cool. We also are all right. So, quick education here. So you moved from apple brandy, Calvados, and you branched out, and this is where my ignorance is profound. So, talk a little bit about spirits for those of us who. Don't know much.
Okay, so we have 3 or 4 hours to go over this.
Yeah, at least.
Exactly. Okay, in general, as you're, fleet of feet and starting a new business, most people with an entrepreneurial bent are somewhat agile and willing to turn course at a moment's notice. And then also there's the significant component of as you're starting a business, it's very nice to have a revenue stream come in sooner rather than later. And in the spirits industry, we have spirits that have been in the barrel for 12 years, so that's 12 years of making it and storing it without seeing dime on your return on investment on that. So things like vodka and gin you can make relatively quickly, that's what we started with. So we started with the vodka, which is basically, you make a mash, you distill it to a high enough proof that it purifies it. In theory, it's odorless and flavorless. And then you can also use that base to make a gin with, and then you add juniper, coriander, angelica, orse, orange, cinnamon, licorice, whatever the botanicals you may want to use to flavor your gin. So we launched after 6 months with a gin and a vodka and a rum that was quite young in the barrel that tasted pretty good at the time. And then retrospectively, when I opened one of those original barrels, it was pretty awful. So
it was that rum with an H? I just saw.
No, it was aged, but it was only, 6 months. And now I don't think we're pouring rum in a bottle that's less than 6 years. And then whiskeys are grain-based. You cannot distill them as high as a vodka, and it sort of forces you to leave some character in them. And for the most part, whiskeys are named after their dominant grain. So rye whiskey is more than half rye, barley more than half barley, bourbon is a sort of standout, and that has to be at least 51% corn and has to be aged in a virgin American oak barrel. And so the guidelines around making a bourbon are a little bit different than the others. So,
which brings us to...
go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say bourbon, which brings us to... We are just doing this interview at the end of, what is it, National Bourbon Month or something?
National Bourbon Heritage
Month. Oh, heritage. You've got to get the word heritage in there.
Yeah, you've got to get that
one in there. All right. So what's, you know, I happen to not be from Kentucky and happen to know that you can make bourbon because all you need is, you can follow the rules as long as you age it. So, But I also know that a lot of people believe that you can only get bourbon in Kentucky, or it's only made in Kentucky. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, so National Bourbon Heritage Month actually was passed by the U.S. Senate in 2007. It also happened to be the year that
you started. Yep.
Coincidence, we're not sure. And bourbon is proprietary to the U.S., so correct. You just have to make it in the U.S. Most people, or a lot of people, feel that it needs to be made in Kentucky, but that is not the case. And then, as I mentioned, it has to be distilled to not over 160 proof. It can't be aged over 125 proof. And then there's a whole bunch of shenanigans about age statements on it, but generally speaking, for a straight bourbon, it has to be at least 2 years of age. So we're fortunate in the Berkshires. We have a lot of great sources for corn around here. We started off using corn that's only a few miles away from us. The smaller grains, the rye and barley, were a little bit harder to get. But we have a great bourbon. It's a gold medal winning bourbon that we make right here in Sheffield. And then we also have different iterations of that bourbon. So we have the general bourbon that's at least 4 years old, Berkshire bourbon. We then, this is a little bit confusing, but we'll take that same bourbon that's already aged 4 years. We have a product called Smoke and Peat that we ran out of for a couple of years and is back in short supply at the distillery. That bourbon's then finished in Scotch barrels, so it's got a wonderful peat to it and smokiness. We also finish our four-year-old bourbon. Right now we have one that's finished in Sam Adams cask barrels that the barrels from Sam Adams used to hold their Utopias beer. We have another one where we finish it in barrels that originally had bourbon, then had maple syrup in it, and then we put bourbon back in once the syrup strained, so it's got just a little hint of sweetness to it. And then also coming up by the end of the year, we're going to release our oldest bourbon, which is 12 years old, but it's very, very limited release. Because as I said, in the beginning, when you start a business, you're looking for a revenue stream, and so we would sell all the bourbon that came of age when it came of age.
Do you have a little coming-of-age party? Like
we should think of a name for it, exactly.
Yeah. No, truly, because yeah. That's kind of... what was the wine thing when they started the Beaujolais Nouveau or something like that? You're just
right.
Like when it... You know, got to have a birthday party for the bourbon. But do you stick with the same recipe now?
The recipe is the same. I went down actually to Kentucky to learn how to make bourbon. Obviously, the terroir of our grains is a little bit different. We don't have their junky limestone water. We've got this wonderful granite spring-based water that we use. We have kept the same recipe all along. Aside from finishing it in different barrels, but by law to be a bourbon, it's got to be aged in a virgin American white oak barrel.
So, a long time ago, long, long time ago, somebody told me that, you know, if you move to a foreign place, your body, it took 7 years, speaking of seven, to for the inside of your body to reflect the outside of where you lived, because, you know, you had to consume the food that was grown in the place from the animals or the plants that were grown in the ground of the butt. So how does that work with the oak, the virgin oak, white oak? Does it matter where it's grown?
It does matter where it's grown. And actually there's been, so pre-COVID, just like a compounding of factors, wet winters where they couldn't harvest white oak and a few other things, and Asia looking to increase their bourbon consumption, it became next to impossible to find U.S.-made white oak barrels. And so a lot of other little cooperages, the companies that make barrels, popped up. And there are studies that have been done mostly by wine folks early on that look at the chemical composition of white oak, Quercus alba, and how that affects the aging of, most of it was done, as I said, for wine, but also spirits. And so it does matter the region where the oak is from, and most of it kind of comes down a little, a few hundred miles south of here. But apparently the New England white oak isn't quite as good for the aging as some of the southern white oaks.
Cool. That was a random curiosity about that.
Glad I could fudge an answer.
Yeah, no, I liked it. I liked it a lot. What do you have? So back to the present for a second, because, again, we could talk history for ages. What do you have going on right this second that you want people to know about?
Wow. So, you know, it's funny. It's being a craft whatever, it's hard to stay relevant. And I always say this, that there are a couple of the big whiskey makers that have made two whiskeys in 150 years, and we put out 12 whiskeys in a year, and people still say, what's new? So,
do they want new?
Though, and what's that?
I said, do they want new? I'm just, this is, if it were up to me, I'd put out, you know, one every 5 years. I would.
Yeah.
That's, because I don't know how you, you know, constantly, there's almost bordering on an obsession with, well, it has to be new. It's like, well, actually, why don't you just learn cursive? You know,
Right. It is. The problem is, as a small supplier, it's very hard to keep relevance in the marketplace. And the bigger companies have, you know, such huge marketing budgets that it's just hard to fight that dollar for dollar in a branding component. So we end up having to create new things, which, by the way, is part of the reason we're in it. And so for me, I get bored with the same thing, and it's great fun to, you know, whether it's the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project, where we work with a dozen and now counting breweries, it's great for these to have these collaborations because it builds a network and it's fun. And so at the moment, we have, let's see, we're bottling another one of our barreled ethereal gins. This one is, I think, close to 8 years old. I don't know anyone else that's really selling a gin that's been in the barrel that long. And when this one's out, we're going to transition to a 10-year-old barrel gin, which is pretty substantial. We're going to release that 12-year-old bourbon at the end of the year, by the end of the year. Let me say that again if you hear that in the background. So we're going to release that 12-year-old bourbon we discussed by the end of the year. We have a 12-year-old a 12-year-old rum that we'll be releasing in the next few months, I think, as well. We have a top-secret gin project that will be coming out fairly soon. We have a lot of irons in the fire now, so we're just trying to chug through them all.
All right, so I just another random question about that, just not knowing. So when it's 12 years old, that's 12 years in the barrel. It's not 12 years from the – how do you – after you've had the birthday party, how do you count?
Yeah, so it is correct. It is 12 years in the barrel.
For example.
So we distill it. You have to proof it down with water. Again, you know, if it's a bourbon, say, you can't age it over 125 proof, and it comes off the still at close to 160 proof. And so we'll blend that down with our spring water. We'll throw it in the barrel. And once it hits the barrel, that's when the clock starts.
Gotcha. And one last question, I guess, I wasn't going to go here, but I just have to since you're captive. And that is, what's proof?
Proof is, in this country, it's double the percent alcohol by volume. So if you have something that in the bottle is 50% of it is ethanol, then that is 100 proof.
Okay. Okay. I got it. So then you need do you need ethanol? It's got to be ethanol?
Ooh, that's another big question. So
okay.
When you ferment something, the products that are produced during that fermentation, the chemical compounds, vary according to the raw materials, the temperature, the yeast strain. In general, the largest percent of an alcohol produced is ethanol, and that's our odorless, flavorless vodka. But there are myriad other compounds. So there's amylene butyl alcohols, and there's fusel oils and esters, and there's methanol. And so all of these things are produced in different ratios according to raw material, temperature, yeast strain, et cetera. And if it's a wine or a beer, you just drink the whole kit and caboodle. If it's a spirit, you can run it through the still, and they all have their own different volatilities. So you can make cuts and get rid of portions that you don't want in the bottle. So we tend to put a very clean, quote, cut in the bottle, which I think kind of helps the next morning. But yes, the vast majority of stuff that you keep from a distillation run is ethanol.
You know, what we have successfully done is people can just come for the tastings now. They don't have to go, you know, they don't want to do the tour or even read the plaques.
Right. And there's actually a great 9-minute film, I believe it is, on the website that shows a little bit about what we do.
And what is the website?
BerkshireMountainDistillers.com. And we are, you know, we grow stuff on my farm here. We grow stuff down at the distillery. We have a garden gin that we put out that we pick Angelica and Orris and different things that we've grown and put it in the garden gin. So we don't grow all of our own grains. We just don't have the space. But we try to grow a bunch of products that we use in our distillations.
And the good news, obviously, about growing something is if you know where you're growing it and you know where it comes from, you are, you know, way, way, way ahead of the life game anyway, like health.
Correct.
Health. It's just like that I would think is going to just become increasingly critical.
Yep, I would agree.
All right, what would you like people to think most if they hear this interview, when they're listening to this interview? What would you like them to think about?
You know, I think somewhat self-serving, right, is that supporting local is a wonderful thing. It helps take advantage of the local multiplier effect. So every dollar you spend at a locally owned business infuses a lot more money into the local economy than it does if you shop at a store that's, you know, headquartered in South Carolina, say. So I just think the importance of local and craft, and whether that's booze or cheese or wine, it's what adds character to a community. And we're super fortunate in the Berkshires that, you know, the first CSA in the country and wonderful restaurants and farms and cheese makers and bread makers. And so, you know, and also at the distillery, we sell a lot of stuff that is just smaller batch that doesn't fit the model for distribution. So we have a lot of one-off things that you can get at the distillery that we just aren't able to offer elsewhere. So I would just say, you know, support local.
I would have to, endorse that, especially as a local radio station. You know, seriously. But is there an age break, a demographic break, that doesn't quite understand the support local concept? Or are you finding that it's pretty easy to get across? Because sometimes I just want to shake people as they're clicking and,
you know,
ordering.
That's also a complicated nut to crack. So I don't think that we have an age bracket that works. And I have a lot of younger people that I know that say, okay, I'm not shopping at beginning with an A anymore, right? But it's so easy to pick up a brand you're familiar with at the supermarket, or it sometimes it's work to shop locally, right? And for everyone. So
yeah,
I don't think it's really relegated to any specific age bracket, though.
All right, then you're incredibly diplomatic, and what I'm going to say is going back to what you were talking about local ingredients, and I think that every age bracket, especially if you are a consumer, would benefit from being slightly more focused on what's actually in what you think you're buying, separate from what the nice ad with the very, you know, music that's reminiscent of a fun time purports.
Right.
How is that? How is that for you not getting in trouble and me?
Yeah, I could comment on like a parallel in the cannabis world on that, but I don't know if we can say that. So
you can.
We can.
You can comment. Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
So
you can't. I mean, there are seven. What was it, George Carlin? I think there are seven things you can't say.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
I'm part of the PASS, which is a wonderful farm-to-label cannabis company in Sheffield. Locally grown cannabis, and when you know, we had a discussion the other day about black market cannabis. It's not paying taxes. Very easy to get, but at the end of the day, you have no idea what's in it, right? So if something went wrong in a grow, it could have been sprayed with fungicides, or back in the 70s, paraquat. And I mean, the nice thing about legal cannabis is you know exactly where it came from. It's been tested for every heavy metal under the sun and pesticide, and so there's transparency that I think is what you were referring to. Sort of the further the distance that something travels, the less accountability there is for it. So if you can go down to Mainline Farm or one of these local places, Stanton's meat at his farm stand, you know where it came from and how it was grown. So. I think that the Berkshires have been great that we've sort of gone back to that model more so than many parts of the country.
And I'm just going to interject saying, brilliant, cutting edge, you're on the vanguard again, and I will be happy to interview you before this becomes known fact. But that is the direction. If you are going to have a working community, if you're going to have a working, I hate the word planet, so... But basically, if things are going to function properly, you've got to know what it is, where it's grown, and what's in it. And mark my words, by 10 years from now, this is going to be such a thing. Because, you don't know, but my brother was Mr. Organic. It was Mr. Earthbound Farm. Before there was a lobby, before there was anything, just because they were growing salad in their backyard and they had to do in California, they had to do something with it.
Yeah.
Which is how a lot of these started. But once it becomes, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it anyway. Once it becomes a thing, the rules around it get a little bit dodgy. And
like organic,
and yeah. I said something last night. I said, yeah, like organic. What are you allowed to do? Like 6% pesticide or something?
Yep.
And I said it's like decaf. How old were you when you found out that decaf was only X percent?
Right. That's why I can't sleep at night. Is that what you're telling me?
Precisely. Well, that and just being on the cutting edge, because being on the cutting edge is a little exhausting.
The monkeys. Get in my brain at 2 in the morning every morning.
Yeah, and they got to say something.
Yeah.
This is Chris. It's been a pleasure. I think that I've banged on long enough, and I'm going to say come back anytime. And this has been Chris Weld, founder and CEO of Berkshire Mountain Distillers in Sheffield. Phone number 413-429-6280.
Nope,
that's totally wrong. Forget that.
423-229-0219 is the.
All right, tell me that again.
413-229-0219.
And the number for the distillery is 413?
That was it. 413-229-0219 is the distillery phone
number. All right, and the web again?
It is BerkshireMountainDistillers.com.
All right. Was there anything else you wanted to tell anybody?
No, just thank you very much for humoring me again. It's always a pleasure to be on.
All right. Take care.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. You don't have to hang up. That's fine.